This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
Well, good evening, everyone, and welcome to Beyond Bars, reflecting on the rights of Victoria's prisoners. This is an event presented by Liberty Victoria in partnership with the Wheeler Centre. My name is George Giorgio, and I'm the current president of Liberty Victoria. Tonight's event will be moderated by Anita Barrow. Anita is a well-known and highly respected journalist. She's a Walkley Award-winning journalist and has worked at the ABC for over 30 years. Anita is the producer of and a presenter on Radio National's multi-award-winning program, The Law Report. So please join with me in making Anita welcome tonight.
So, as George said, this Liberty Victoria event, in combination with the Wheeler Centre, is called Beyond Bars, Reflecting on the Rights of Victoria's Prisoners. And when I thought about this, I thought, well, you know, some will say committing a crime means you lose your rights. But does it mean losing all rights? And as we've heard over the last couple of days, prisoners are making their views felt very loudly about their right to smoke, as all correction facilities are now smoke-free as of today. But earlier yesterday, we know there were riots. But what are the rights of prisoners? Do we care? Should we? They're detained there to keep our community safe. But more than 50% of these prisoners are not getting far beyond the bars before they're back behind them again. So our prisons are bursting, as George said, the highest rate in over a decade. So there has to be questions asked about whether our prisons are working as effectively as they should. And of course, it is in our interest, in everybody's interest, because in the end, the majority of those prisoners will be back out here in the community. So for this conversation, our very experienced and esteemed panel, Deborah Glass, OBE. She's the Victorian Ombudsman and she heads the Independent Statutory Agency, which actually helps keep our institutions accountable. She investigates complaints, identifies systematic failures, and her recent discussion paper on Victoria's prisons raises many concerns about whether rehabilitation and transition programs are keeping up with this swelling population. So, warm welcome to Deborah. And next to Deborah is Bronwyn Naylor. She's an Associate Professor at Monash University at the Faculty of Law, and she's published widely on issues around human rights in prison populations, and very usefully, she's looked at overseas jurisdictions as well as the wider Australian and Territory situations. So what can we learn from other countries? And I'm sure we'll find some. So welcome to Bronwyn. And Lisa Harrison at the far end, she's a former researcher. She actually worked closely with Bronwyn at Monash. Actually, all of these panellists are Monash Uni alumni, which is a bit strange, something in the water, I think. Or maybe I think it's actually the public transport. It's so difficult to get there. You have to be strong. But she's currently a volunteer at the Northern Territory Legal Aid Commission based in Darwin. She's flown down here especially for this event. And she's also looked at, and I think very appropriately for tonight's conversation, she's looked at internet use for education in the prison population. So welcome to Lisa. So let's start. Ombudsman Deborah Glass, you're investigation into prisoner rehabilitation and reintegration in Victoria. What prompted that investigation?
I started a 10-year term, lovely to have a 10-year term, by the way, as a Victorian Ombudsman, in March of last year. When I came into the role, I grew up in Melbourne, but I spent the last 30 years out of the country, and I wanted to understand what the issues were affecting the state. You know, what do you take on? I've got a lovely set of powers to investigate things systemically, but how do you use those, and you know, what are the fundamental issues that I should be using them on? So I was looking at the patterns of complaints, what was coming in, what were the numbers telling me?
And you had a lot more complaints too, I understand.
Well, absolutely, but the first thing that that I noticed in this role is that it is the number one, prisons are the number one source of complaints to my office. We get over 3,000 a year. Now, that's not altogether surprising, actually, because there is a free call number to the Ombudsman's office in every Victorian prison. And if you go into a prison, you'll see there's a little card next to the phone that has the Ombudsman's line on it. So my staff get frequent phone calls from prisoners. But the result of that is that we know that there is a, you know, there are a lot of issues in our prisons, and we've got a fair idea of what they are. So looking at prisons and thinking about what are the issues here that I should be investigating, I looked at where we've been before. Now, my predecessor has done quite a lot of work in that area. He tabled a report on deaths in custody in the prisons shortly before I took up the role. He's done quite a lot of other work in it. So I wanted to look at what hadn't been done before. What were some of the key issues that were coming out as a result of the increase in prisoner numbers? And the issue of rehabilitation, reintegration came through as a very obvious one. We haven't looked at this before. It must be a compelling issue, bearing in mind the pattern of prisoner complaints and bearing in mind the issues around reoffending.
So those issues that you speak out, what were the issues? What were they complaining about?
Well, you know, we get complaints about people not getting access to programs. You know, people who have applied for parole, who are being told that they have to do certain programs in order to get parole, but there aren't enough programs available, or because there are too many people trying to get into them. You know, people are delaying applying for their parole because they can't get access to the things that are required for them to make their applications. So that, you know, that's an area of complaint that we've seen quite significantly.
And is it that what happens then is that they can't get parole because they haven't fulfilled their conditions of their
there's two potential consequences to those, to the reforms in the parole area. One is that people who are trying to get parole are not getting it because they're not getting the access to the programs they need to comply with the requirements of the parole board. And the other consequence is that people actually aren't applying for parole at all. So more and more prisoners are coming out into the community on what's called straight release, which means they're not being monitored, they're not being supervised, they're simply going potentially from a maximum security prison into the community with no controls in place at all.
Bronwyn Naylor, as Deborah says, there's this big increase in the prison population. And it's 25% in the last 2 years, which is extraordinary. There's over 7,000 inmates. It's a huge jump. Does this mean there's more crime being committed?
Okay. I think one would tend to assume that that is what's happening, that there is some relationship between crime rates, increasing crime and increasing prison populations. But the research in Australia and internationally shows that there's almost no relationship actually between crime rates and increases in crime and the use of imprisonment, which is sort of counterintuitive, but it's very clearly been demonstrated. So on the one hand, I would note that the crime rate in Victoria is actually pretty stable. There are some crimes that are slightly increased from this year, some crimes that are down this year. But I think the drivers for that extraordinary increase in the prison population are at least three factors. First of all, there's the issue of more people being required to being held in remand and not getting bail. So when a person's first arrested, there's a decision made as to whether they can have bail in the community or be remanded in custody. And more people are now being held on remand. So 18 to 20% of the entire prison population is actually people who haven't yet been sentenced.
And sometimes they're in remand for a long time, too.
Yes, they can be in remand for very long periods of time before going for trial. So there's the issue of who's coming in, more people coming in. There are more people coming into the prisons because of changes in sentencing requirements and sentencing legislation in the last 2 or 3 years in particular, abolition of suspended sentences, loss of home detention, and a number of changes in terms of expectations that courts will sentence to prison rather than to a non-custodial term. So that's, again, coming into prison. And at the other end, as Deborah's mentioned, there is a significant decrease in people being released on parole. So there's real sort of push at both ends of the system that have led to these increases.
So you're talking about these programs, not getting access to programs. What kind of programs are we talking about Lisa Harrison, Liberty Victoria as well, in its submission, highlighted this concern about the access to rehabilitation and transition programs. What kind of programs?
So I'm not based in Victoria anymore, but there's certainly been issues raised by Liberty Victoria about particular offender behaviour change programs that are available in prisons that are kind of the crux of parole reforms. The whole idea is that you're providing sex offender programs within prison so that people, notorious sex offenders, and we all know the recent cases in Melbourne, that they're not released on parole without having undertaken programs that someone can attest to them having changed behaviour. And there's been a few notable cases where, and Liberty Victoria talks about this in their submission, where, for instance, someone with a well-documented history of mental health concerns and drug addiction was not able to access rehabilitation programs during the prison term, and then upon release shortly afterwards attacked someone with a knife. And that was a problem of lack of access to the program within the prison, and something that's clearly identifiably fixable because we can add that program in. Other cases of sexual offences, which again has been quite topical in Victoria, where we have people who are wanting to do sex offender programs and not able to access them, and then upon release are reoffending. We had a notable Court of Appeal decision recently where it was found on appeal that there was a real issue. It was his reoffending was the direct consequence of not having access to that program in prison. So it's clearly established that there's a need within this kind of captive audience in prison that we are delivering programs to change behaviour so that when people come out to the community, they're safer.
And that really brings it to the nub of it, doesn't it? Because on the one hand, you have prisoners wanting to access programs, not getting access, having to fulfil their whole sentence, not being out on parole, but just getting a clean sentence out on the thing, often ending up homeless with no identification, and they reoffend and they're back in prison again. But as you say, there's been some high-profile cases. I mean, do we really care? I mean, should we really worry about the rights of prisoners when you have the press saying, you know, terrible people, Adrian Bailey, those kinds of people in who are on parole who then recommit and commit terrible crimes? You know, what should be done about balancing that idea of prison, rehabilitation programs, reoffending programs, and allowing people, the community, to be safe?
Well, I think it's a common reaction, particularly with notable examples of people that go back after spending time and often repeated times in prison, go back to reoffend, that we question as a community, why is it that we think prisoners deserve certain things? When we're aware, we have a criminal justice process that says we don't assume guilt, we prove guilt, and at that point they're there to be judged. The idea about human rights is, as a framework, is accepting that everyone, no matter what they've done, is eligible and entitled to certain basic things just by virtue of their humanity. And we accept as a society that even people who do horrendous things, genocidal murderers in an international criminal context, murderers and rapists, are entitled to certain basic treatment. And it's the idea that we as a society are judged by how we treat those people that are dislikable, that there's a reason to not like them. They're still entitled to certain things. So that's one part about we should look at how we're defined as a community, but it's also about, well, what are we providing for people in prison so that when they are ultimately released, they've had a certain basic treatment, they've been treated with respect, and so they're more likely to then respond positively in the community when they're released.
Well, so Deborah Glass, what are the responsibilities and duties of our correctional facilities?
Well, essentially to provide people in custody with a safe environment, you know, that ensures their safety and well-being. There's a raft of, in addition to the Corrections Act, raft of procedures and instructions, commissioners' requirements, deputy commissioners' instructions and the like, which cover a whole, you know, the entire gamut of policies and procedures within the corrections environment from go to woe.
Does that include a responsibility to engage offenders in positive behavioural change?
It does, and I can actually quote from the corrections' own website if I can find the relevant bit. I mean, they even say that their stated purpose is to contribute to safer communities by delivering a safe, secure and humane correctional system. And they do this, they say, through actively engaging with offenders in the community to promote positive behavioural change and address social disadvantage.
And is that being done in your... In your view, following?
Well, you might have to wait for the final investigation report of this piece of work for the definitive answer to that one, but I think the evidence in the discussion paper is pretty clear.
No. Well, I have a story, and it's I think, a person I know very well and who's become a friend. She ticks all the boxes for disadvantage. Female, Indigenous, mother was a member of the Stolen Generation, so this child was taken out of care, put in foster homes, in and out of juvenile detention, prostitution, drug addict, lots of offences, ends up in the adult prison system, in and out, and then finally gets caught up with a bad man, as often happens with female prisoners, as opposed to male prisoners. There's a slightly different offences for women. But she ends up with a crime that's not victimless. And it's a huge wake-up call for her. She's, you know, there is a victim in her crime. So she serves her sentence. She's released full of good intentions and grand things. She does get a job. She gets a flat. But, you know, she rang me up and said, I've flooded the laundry, Anita. What do I do? She's overstuffed the washing machine. She doesn't know how to change a light bulb. Things have changed since her long prison sentence. She doesn't know how to do online banking, organise a mobile phone. All of these absolute life skills she doesn't know. A real failure there, isn't there?
Well, that raises real questions about not only what goes on in corrections, but the whole transitional environment. Mm. And, I mean, there's a concept of through care that exists in New Zealand, for other jurisdictions.
ACT.
That starts with when somebody comes into the system, how are they going to be managed out of it? You know, so through their passage through the correctional system, all the way through to release and after release. And this is about considering people's needs, whether that's their health needs, their housing needs.
Literacy.
Yeah, there are so many. I mean, what we see all too often in looking at prisons, this is not news, they are schools of disadvantage.
And this Indigenous woman I spoke about, she at least had housing. I understand, you know, your discussion paper identifies that many end up homeless.
Well, there are some pretty shocking numbers, particularly for women prisoners, because many of them are the victims of domestic violence. And one of the reasons they're homeless, of course, is that they don't want to, you know, they don't or can't go back to the environment that they left. So they actually go back to prison because it's safer there.
Yeah. It comes back, Bronwyn Naylor, to the idea of rights for prisoners, the right for prisoners to have access to rehabilitation, to be able to reintegrate, to be able to lead to a safer community. What are the rights of prisoners, either Bronwyn or Lisa?
Well, in Victoria, it's a bit of a clearer jurisdiction to know what prisoners' rights are because of the particular rules we have about human rights. But the Victorian Parliament was quite forward-thinking back in the 80s, and in the Corrections Act that defines what prison authorities can and can't do, they have listed particular things that prisoners have what they call a right to. And these are basic things that when you think about the fact that prisoners are in a place where they don't get to provide anything for themselves, that they're assured that they will receive food and adequate food, and that includes the right to culturally appropriate food. as well as basic shelter, so the conditions that they're kept in. They have access to open air and exercise, so sunlight, that they are able to practice religion as a fundamental human right, access to reasonable healthcare as well, and that means access to healthcare within the prison and also the ability to access private health providers externally as well. So they're all basic things, like I said, that we all expect that everyone, in order to survive, has access to. And in Victoria, we have those stated in the Corrections Act, but we also have the additional layer that the Victorian Charter of Rights provides, which is a way of articulating some international principles right here in Victoria, saying things like all prisoners, all people, and prisoners being people, are entitled to respectful treatment, humane treatment, that they should not be tortured or treated cruelly or inhumanely. And that's a particular concern in a prison environment, as with anywhere where people are held in a confined space, that there's a real risk of abuse of power. And Victorian Parliament has thought it necessary to articulate those rights, and they clearly apply to prisoners as well.
What about the right to education?
That is, yeah, no, you're right, that was a clear omission. So international law clearly recognises the right of all people to education, and that's an express right that the Victorian Parliament acknowledged for prisoners back in the 80s and stands today.
And briefly, I know that, Bronwyn, you interviewed a number of prison staff and inmates in Victoria and in WA as well as part of your research into human rights in closed environments. What were some of the responses? I mean, this idea of human rights can be seen as a bit fluffy and, you know, did they actually understand the principles and what they're about?
Yes, well, it's been an interesting research project to get a sense of, first of all, big picture, what rights are relevant and applicable in prisons, but then how do you actually implement those in secure, closed environments? It's sort of really, really challenging. But I think it's been really important as a starting point, and Lisa outlined the fact that in Victoria we have a Charter of Rights, and the Charter of Rights embodies the international rights, such as you're saying, freedom from torture, cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, rights to equality, rights to privacy protection, rights to family protection, and makes it really clear that when you walk into a prison, you don't lose your rights by reason of going into prison. You only lose the rights that must be lost because you're being held in incarceration, in custody. So clearly you lose freedom of movement and so on. But that's a really important starting point. And I think it's a distinction for the jurisdictions in Australia, which is only Victoria and the ACT, that have rights instruments, that it's made really clear that you have explicitly the rights that everyone else has, unless their modification or loss can be justified. And that's a really important point. So speaking to prisoners, first of all, I would say that I don't think that many people in the community are that au fait with their rights in terms of the international framework of rights. Therefore, the fact that prisoners were not particularly aware of that, I don't think is surprising, and it's not a particular criticism of them. I think they were quite surprised to know that they still had rights, and they were very aware that rights can, of course, be balanced off against other obligations, other rights such as security.
Security, yes.
They did feel it was really valuable to be able to frame certain concerns in rights terms and issues around respect and issues around not being subject to cruel, inhuman and degrading treatment were really important. They also highlighted, for example, and some of them used rights language and some didn't, and this was the case both in WA and Victoria, A, the importance of being treated with respect as a human being. That was really crucial. And a really important applied right, practical right, was access to family and family contact. And I should say that I don't think either of those is exactly difficult to implement. They don't require vast resourcing. They require taking rights seriously when you manage your prison. And I guess when we get on to things like programs, access to programs, there are other resourcing issues which do raise other issues.
But do those resourcing issues then undermine those rights? The fact that there's no resources or few resources for these rehabilitation transitional programs, is that undermining rights? Before we get that, we should really just briefly talk about the smoking issue. I mean, the right to smoke. Mm-hmm. I mean, smoking, you've done some research on this, and I mean, it is tricky because there's a health and safety issue playing out here too.
Most certainly, and it's obviously extremely topical at the moment. Mm. But I think that we can think about that by using that human right lens that I mentioned, the starting point that people in prison don't lose the rights we all have. If any of us went into prison tomorrow, heaven forbid, we would go in with the same rights that we have today, only modified by what's necessary for reasons of security and the balancing of interests in a prison. So whilst there's not a human right, an international human right to smoke, there are, as I've mentioned, rights to equal treatment, rights to privacy, rights to family, rights to not having your home life arbitrarily interfered with. Mm. And I think there's at least a way of thinking about this issue of saying, is it necessary to ban smoking in order to balance the rights that we're talking about, the rights to a safe work environment for the staff, the safety of other prisoners in terms of secondhand smoke and so on, is an absolute ban really necessary if we start from that presumption that you have to explain and justify why someone might lose those other rights like the privacy in the general community? Of course, smoking is legal, unhealthy, but legal, and we don't ban smoking except in particular public places. So I think there needs to be at least a discussion about why it's necessary to ban it everywhere in a prison.
And Deborah, I think, do you have comments?
Well, a little historical reference there you might find interesting. I was doing a bit of research into my predecessors, and I was reading some reports of the first Victorian Ombudsman, Sir John Dillon, who in the 70s, and he lists in his first 5 years' achievements numbers of things he did involving prisons. In addition to changing the policies that forced prisoners in H Division Pentridge to break rocks, which he listed as one of his achievements, and ensuring they had beds. you actually think, I thought it was the 1870s where I was reading about, but it was in fact the 1970s. But one of the achievements he listed in the 70s was getting prisoners the right to smoke in their cells and in yards.
So it's a complete turnaround.
I looked at that and I thought, right.
So we should go back to the 70s in some areas and not in others?
We will see.
I mean, saying.
Will I get a lot of complaints about this one? Well, it's, what's today? The 1st of July. We will see.
Well, I want to get on to education because we're going to run out of time otherwise. My Indigenous friend managed while she was in prison to complete high school, do a degree and a master's. That's how long she was in prison. But this was in the 80s and 90s, so it was all done by correspondence. Nowadays, any kind of education program is online. You can't do a correspondence course unless you do it online. Now, Lisa Harrison, you've looked at the internet education, in particular in the ACT at this human rights, a prison correctional facility in Canberra called the Alexander McConachie Centre, which is named after a very interesting 19th century prison reformer, or a Scottish stew full of turnips. but anyway, they have got a limited access to the internet for educational purposes. Can you just describe what's happening there?
Certainly. I mean, and it's probably strange for people to think that prisoners have access to the internet, and it's unusual in corrections as well. It's the only place in the country where prisoners have a form of access to the internet. They have a whitelisting process. So they have a very secure network that's been established where certain websites are accessible and certain email addresses are authorised by the prison for prisoners to access using communal computers. So there's physical monitoring in terms of a staff member there present whilst they're using the internet, but there's also electronic monitoring. And that's a really key thing, is that the advent of technology also means there's an advent of capacity to watch. And there's more surveillance when you're tracking what someone's doing as they're doing in real time, and they're able to do that with this program.
Except there have been problems. Mm. Let's admit this. Mm. There was almost 50 mobiles been smuggled in the last 20 months in this facility, and earlier this year a couple of inmates posted some selfies. There was a video posted of a prison fight. There are real concerns, aren't there? I mean, it's really tricky.
It is, and it's a vexed issue. And obviously technology, there, as we all know, is want to break at points. I think the question is whether we think it's worth keeping it off the table because there's any risk of it not working in terms of technological capacity, but also in terms of prisoners and whether there's a risk that people might abuse this right or abuse this process. And it's likely that there will be some people who will try and exploit this in the same way that there'll be people trying to exploit mail systems. So prisoners have had access to communications with the outside world previously in a monitored way. So they will have physical mail that goes through a team who will see whether it contains any illegal information, whether it's contacting victims, trying to be involved in crime. I don't think that because there's a risk, it means that we rule it out altogether. I think, as Bronwyn was saying, the human rights framework says we try and assess what's the most reasonable limitation we can have to this right that takes account of everyone's rights. So should everyone be punished in the prison, and particularly in terms of access to education, should anyone who wants to undertake higher education in prison not be able to do that feasibly? Because there will be some people who will exploit this system.
Well, what's the benefit of education in prison, Bronwyn and Deborah? What? How do we benefit in the community from prisoners having education?
Well, I'll make a comment, and then I'm sure Deborah's got a lot more knowledge in this area as well. I think the first point to note, as you said from your illustration, as you gave from your illustration, is education today is really internet-based. If we're going to make sure that prisoners have access to education, we have to really think seriously about the online environment and about ensuring that they can get access to a good education. And I don't think any of us here would know how to function without access to the internet now, in terms of Google, let alone anything else. Am I allowed to say Google?
Of course.
Search engines and other such things where we find information. I mean, how do we find the information that we find these days? We use the internet constantly, let alone accessing government services, agencies, employment and so on. So I think that's a really important aspect. And I think it's very clear that people come into prison overall from a very disadvantaged population. They are a very disadvantaged group. They're a group with generally speaking, not entirely, but generally speaking, low levels of education, poor experience of employment, and in addition, often issues around mental health, competence issues, addiction issues. And education can be one way of really supporting their re-establishment or establishment, settlement for the first time in the community. So it's going to be a really important way of making sure that the community actually is much safer, because people are much less likely to re-offend, given a good chance to re-establish themselves in the community. So I think it's really vital.
I was reading about an Institute of Criminology study done, I think it was back in 2008, of Queensland prisoners. There was a survey of 1,800 Queensland prisoners, and they surveyed who'd done some vet or tertiary education, vocational courses, and the recidivism of those who'd done courses was markedly less. There was something like only 23% of those surveyed who'd done education were reoffended. So there's clearly a story here about rehabilitation, education being key. And just briefly, I don't want to take over, but briefly, I spoke to a former prisoner earlier today who was able to complete a double degree in commerce and IT in prison in Victoria. And sadly, the final year became very awkward because he had to do a software program for a real client, couldn't get software. So he was able to get access to a smuggled internet device and put it on the hard drive. That was found in the prison on the hard when they did an audit. He got into trouble, spent 2 weeks in solitary confinement, was transferred to a maximum security prison. There was good news. He was able to complete that degree, and in fact the real world software program thing that he built was so successful that company hired him. So he now is a tax-paying member of the community following this degree. That's a really good news story, but it does highlight the issue of access to education. Bronwyn, have you got any thoughts on... Oh, Bronwyn and Deborah.
Well, I think the point here, and it's been made already by Bronwyn, is that education shouldn't be regarded as a luxury. It should be regarded as something that prisons do. You know, that this is, you know, that to take your example around the effect on recidivism, and we know this is widely known. So it goes back to that question we start at the beginning. You know, what is the system doing to make it less likely that people who are in prison will go back there?
So what can we do now? What's the nub of this? What's the key practical and achievable things that can happen to help lower this recidivism rate and help our community keep safer, essentially?
There's never going to be a single answer to this one. I mean, if you look at the profile of prisoners, people with significant, on the whole, mental health problems, problems with substance abuse, drugs and alcohol, low literacy, all of the features of disadvantage that you find in our society are magnified in prisons. So you actually can't look at these issues and think that the answer lies just within the correction system.
Exactly. So what can be achievable? What's practical? What can we do now? Or what can happen? What could be done? Bronwyn.
Well, a quick solution to the entire problem.
Oh, yes. Well, we're solving the world's problems.
Of course, we're solving the world's problems.
But I mean, there could be. I mean, education clearly is a key.
Yes. I think just to note very briefly, and I think this has been at least flagged by the current government, and I don't know how far it's been considered, there are broader issues around concepts such as what's referred to as justice reinvestment. Which is perhaps not a solution for today or this week, but it's a solution that governments are looking at around the world, which is saying, what are we spending on prisons? Could we be using some of that money to support either non-prison sentences...
Diversion programs,
or indeed, I think more radically and more usefully, supporting people at an earlier stage before they find themselves sliding into the criminal justice system. Many people do just slide in. It's not something that they plan to be a big-time gangster or whatever. It's to do with all those issues of disadvantage and lack of choice, really. So that if you're looking at things like better funding for literacy, better funding for education, better funding for maternal child health care, really at the very beginning for families that are having a lot of difficulties, we could really look at very significant changes to the number of people actually finding their way into the criminal justice system first up.
That's a big call.
And
that's
interestingly, one of the places that this has been most used will surprise you is in the United States. I mean, Texas, for example, has been at the forefront of justice reinvestment. I mean, not a place that you would think would be, you know, would be focusing on these issues, but actually what they found was that the cost of prisons was blowing out and it was staggering. And they actually moved to a justice reinvestment focus and saved hundreds of millions of dollars.
Lisa?
Lessons for us, possibly.
Well, I think at the other end, it's also about examining why we're having, as Bronwyn talked about before, why the numbers are so big, because the cost is so prohibitive. And we talk about that there's clear evidence that that education in prisons can have a market effect on recidivism. So we can actually reduce the number of people ending up there, but it's a matter of pouring funds into education programs. And when we have issues of overcrowding where we're having to build new prisons, to the idea that, and I think this was in the discussion paper that Deborah's prepared as well, that rehabilitation is the thing that drops off when there's a pressure on beds, and it does become about spending money to build. So part of it is looking at, well, why are people ending up in prisons, and are the reforms that are designed to protect the community, like changes to parole, are those things that are pushing more people into the criminal justice system really the right way to go? Part of that's investing money in prevention programs, but it's also examining our criminal laws, our bail laws. I'm from the Northern Territory, and our incarceration rates are through
huge.
The roof, and our Indigenous population, 30% of the population versus the general population versus 85% of the prison population. You have to ask, the criminal laws aren't working the right way, that the mandatory sentencing that's leading, the bail restrictions, the tough law and order approach that supposedly is protecting the community is actually just funneling more people into a system that's not funded enough to actually care for them enough or create change in them when they come out at the other end.
And just finally, before we go to audience, have questions. So I get the feeling essentially what we're saying here is that it's in the community's interest to give human rights to prisoners. Would you agree with that? It's in all of our interests that prisoners get these rights, which include the right to rehabilitation programs, transition programs, education, as well as all of the other human rights about food and shelter.
I think sometimes the language of rights is deceptive because it suggests an entitlement, a personal claim on someone else. And when we're talking about someone who's taken away someone else's right, the victim has suffered a rights abuse in that process. It's conflictual to think about giving them rights. But if we reframe that language, sometimes it's more helpful. But the fundamental aspect of it is we're giving someone the right to an education. We're giving them the means to become a better person at the end of it. That's the hope.
Bronwyn?
Yes, well, and I think more broadly, going back to my point about taking those rights seriously in that really basic way, it's treating people seriously and seeing them as people who therefore are entitled to be given the best chance that they've got, not assuming we can just lock them up and throw away the key. So I think it's also taking rights seriously in terms of making sure we put supports in place for people to maximise their potential once they come out again.
And you've written, I think you've said, offenders are sent to prison as punishment, not for punishment. That's key.
Absolutely.
And Deborah, a final comment from you?
This is fundamentally about community safety. I mean, this is about, you know, rehabilitation is about ensuring that prisoners actually become rehabilitated members of the community so they don't offend, so there aren't further victims of crime, and that we don't have to spend money on imprisoning them.
And so, I mean, there's lots to talk about, and we've only covered half of it, I think. But I'd love to open the conversation to the audience. Is there anyone who's got... I have to take my glasses off, because now...
Oh, yes, thank you. Very interesting. I'm interested in the runaway demise of natural justice in this country. I was interested to hear the other day that incarceration actually means cancellation. And as pointed out by our speakers, increasing numbers of people being denied bail and actually spending much more time from the word go in jail cannot have any good consequences for the community. My question is, what does the panel think about the criminalisation of young people due to racial profiling by the state, as we see happening every day? Secondly, the criminalisation of women, and in particular young women, around mental health issues to do with stillbirth, SIDS and manslaughter charges. That's a worrying trend. And thirdly, with the intergenerational aspect, children growing up in families where parents have gone in and out of jail with mental health issues not being addressed and ending up, the cycle continues.
Revolving door, yes. Well, that's big.
I'm happy to...
Yes, please.
..stab at that. I mean, I think those are some really big issues that you raise. You know, numbers of them are set out in my discussion paper. And interestingly, you know, in the response that we had to the discussion paper, we also focused on young people because that's, in addition to other areas where we thought we needed to focus particularly on vulnerable communities, people pointed out to us quite rightly that the issues affecting young people in the prison system are particularly serious. And you know, I think the answer there is if you can get people early, if you can actually rehabilitate them early, then you will break that vicious cycle that goes through the generations.
Yes?
With recidivism, I was just wondering what's happening to assist former prisoners with finding work, given the stigma and the police checks that people go through. How are we helping them to find an honest way of supporting themselves?
That is a huge issue, and I think a discussion for a whole hour, I reckon. It is a real problem about reintegration. How do you get people work when they've got a criminal record? As Bronwyn, I think you've worked a bit on this, haven't you?
A bit. I mean, I think you've identified the problem.
That's huge.
Increasingly, I guess over the last 10, 15 years, we've seen employers more and more using record checks, criminal record checks, as a sort of form of reference checking or risk management, for example. So it becomes a sort of default question. It does then make it very difficult for someone with a criminal record to get a job. Some employers do take the time to ask the person to explain what the record might be about and to try to actually assess whether any record is relevant to the job. If it's a record for dishonesty, if it's a record for violence, you know, these are going to be relevant. But in a market where there's more people looking for work than there are jobs, that becomes more difficult, and employers are more readily able to say, well, look, we're just not going to consider that person because they're a potential risk. I mean, I think that the prison system has been working quite hard at establishing or developing some skills, industry-based skills. They do have a lot of links. They try to have a lot of links with employers to encourage them to take prisoners from particular industry programs and training programs. There are some financial incentive schemes, some supports for employers to assist them to employ someone for a period to help that person get back into the discipline of work. Because if you've been in prison for quite some time, it's really difficult to get back into that discipline of getting up and getting to work every day to begin with, let alone losing some of those skills that we all expect in a workplace, leaving aside the criminal record. So there really are significant issues. And I do think it's a very difficult issue.
And I think the Law Institute of Victoria earlier this year actually put in a proposal to the Attorney General about spent convictions, and also in particular for juveniles, for young people, for it not to go on their record, if depending on what the crime was, but for less serious crimes, for it to be wiped, essentially, to give a clean slate so that there was a positive way forward for young people in particular.
Victoria is the only state that doesn't have one of those sorts of statutory schemes.
Mm.
But the statutory scheme doesn't lead to the wiping, if you want to put it that way, of offences for 10 years, even 10. Minor offences. So how you're supposed to manage if you leave prison and sit around for 10 years until you're able to get a job, I'm not quite sure. And then to anticipate that people are somehow going to not reoffend is really, I think, incredibly unrealistic.
Hi, Anita. I'm Stephanie. I'm from ABC as well.
Hi.
Just thought I'd disclose that, ABC News. I just want to hear a bit more about the overcrowding issue and compared to the stuff we heard about the Northern Territory, which has been well publicised, and I know a past Ombudsman's report has talked about that leading to tension and assaults on prison staff and violence. So when does the overcrowding issue in Victoria cross over into the human rights territory, and do you see that as an ongoing issue?
Well, I think we've sort of... That's kind of was part of the conversation, but I mean, earlier this year they were talking about people's in container, you know, shipping containers, and overcrowding people, two or three, four people in a bunk. Not as bad as Northern Territory, where I think there was stories of 16 people in rooms. Mm. But it's certainly getting bad. I mean, from your report.
Well, the numbers have actually come down slightly. The forecast from Corrections for 30th of June in the report was over 7,000. Actually, it is lower than it was in January. So they are, I think, working quite hard to minimise this very serious problem. But there's no doubt, and you know, and I am, and my predecessors are very much on record as talking about the problems of overcrowding in prisons and the way that raises tensions.
And as we've seen overnight, because part of the problem with the remand centre riots was because they are overcrowded. Was it not? That was what it was reported as part of the smoking and people getting
I think
very
in 24
hit.
Hours we probably may not be able to jump directly to conclusions. I've no,
no
doubt
this is
being investigated,
and
not by me, may I say.
That is true, but that seems to be the assumption. Yeah. Anybody?
Hi, Hi, Michelle McDonald from the Smart Justice Project. So with record prisoner numbers, we know that the number one complaint to the Victorian Ombudsman's Office is prisoner complaints. Mm-hmm. Does the panel think that it's really time that we had an independent, full-time, dedicated prisoner watchdog and independent inspectorate in Victoria to increase transparency and accountability around what's happening inside prisons?
Well, I'm happy to comment on that because I know this has been the subject of recommendations by my predecessor who felt that the Office of Correctional Services needed to be independent of the Department of Justice. And he certainly, that was one of the relatively small number of his recommendations that was not accepted. I haven't myself repeated that recommendation, but I do know that it has been made. In the meantime, my office, which is certainly independent, does play that part as best it can. The reality is, however, that prisons are only a small part of my jurisdiction. So although my staff do inspect prisons, and we will, we do that regularly, it's not something that I'm either directly funded for, you know, nor is it part of my core business. But in the absence of other independent agencies who are checking on people in custody, I think it's a very important part of my job.
Occasionally they are audited too. The Auditor General has done investigations into prison, and that's across all states and territories.
Yeah, so there are a number of monitoring mechanisms. I think a very significant feature of the Victorian Ombudsman Office is that it does have also human rights compliance monitoring role given to it under the charter and by the legislation, which is very unusual for an Ombudsman Office to have, I think, a human rights component. So I think that makes Victoria's model quite strong. There are independent agencies, specific independent statutory inspectorates in Western Australia, which has a very strong and quite long-standing record now of what we would call robust reviews of prison conditions and public reporting. And there's a New South Wales inspectorate, which is relatively new. So I think these are very important. Mm-hmm. And more broadly, there are international monitoring requirements under various optional protocols under international conventions, which do introduce and highlight the importance of this sort of oversight, as you've said. This is just issue of transparency and accountability. You know, public reporting, public monitoring of prisons is a really important way of protecting rights as well. And that's something that I think is still under debate in Australia, but in very, very competent hands here, of course, in Victoria.
And not all not all states, their ombudsmen actually investigate prisons, do they? Northern Territory, I don't think, has only done one in the last...
Only two in the last 10 years
so many.
Or so.
Yeah. So we're very lucky here in Victoria.
I think it's also
important...
have
a robust ombudsman, basically.
Well, and the NT Ombudsman did a report looking at the women in prisons back in 2008 that made a series of recommendations, including about access to education and internet access, but the take-up of those recommendations has been quite poor. I think it's also important in a rights context to think about enforcement, and that's often people's concern in the general community about rights, is that how can you enforce a right? And one way is through making complaints to an investigative body like the Ombudsman. It's important that even with a charter, so we're kind of pretty forward thinking in Victoria that we have this document that says what our rights are, but there's no cause of action. I can't go to court and claim that someone's breached my rights directly. There's a roundabout way that you can raise those arguments, but you also have to have an existing reason to go to court. So prisoners don't have the capacity, if something's gone wrong, to bring an action saying my rights have been abused, I haven't been provided the education that I need in order to be rehabilitated. And even the Corrections Act that says you have a right to education doesn't specify what that has to look like. It's not specific enough, and the courts won't intervene to say this is how you should spend your money on these programs. They would defer to the discretion and power of the prison authority. So in that context, when we don't have an enforceable mechanism, it's especially important that we have some form of public reporting so we're aware of what issues are happening, and that's our means of enforcement.
There was one court case I recall, I think, a couple of years ago, of a young man who couldn't get access to finish his year 12, and he was 21, and he was transferred to a juvenile detention centre because he could complete his VCE at that facility.
Yes, it was a New South Wales case, and that was an interesting one because the juvenile facility then did have internet access, and that was the reason that he was transferred, was because he needed the internet access in order to complete his HSC.
I think we've got time for one final question, I think. There, way up somewhere. Yes.
I had a couple of questions, so you might want to pick. The first is, can we talk about prison reform without talking about drug law reform? And secondly, in terms of who's going to prison. But secondly, returning to the issue of violence, as someone who has had a family member in prison, it seems that overcrowding does significantly impact on the violence people are subjected to. That in turn means that people are coming out of prison often traumatised. And I wonder what you think can be done to make prisons safer, both for prisoners, and so that when they come back out, they're not themselves responding to that trauma by being at times violent to others.
That's tragic. Mm. And it's
reduce the number of people in prisons. I mean, you know, this is all the themes we've been discussing. I mean, if prisons need to be safe places that actually encourage those people in them to become productive members of the community when they leave. And if they're not achieving that objective, then, you know, all is lost, you know. So you really have to just go back to the causes of, you know, why do people go in and why do they go back there? Mm. And it's so, you know, if you have a limited focus on bricks and mortar, you know, if you're responding to the overcrowding problem by building more prisons, that's never going to be the answer.
Although I do note that the new Ravenhall facility that they're building on the existing one, the new 1,000-bed, has a sort of policy of payment by result based on recidivism rates. I think that's kind of an interesting little idea. But anyway, I think we have to wind up. I'd really love to thank you, audience. You've been a really lovely, warm audience. It's really nice to look at on your intelligent faces. But I'd really love to thank our wonderful panel here, Victorian Ombudsman Deborah Glass, Associate Professor Bronwyn Naylor, and legal researcher and Lisa Harrison, who's, as we've said, flown all the way from Darwin just to be here tonight. Really dedicated. I thank them all. I'd also like to thank the Wheeler Centre, Helen Withycombe, Emily Sexton, Sophie Quick, the incredibly dedicated staff at Liberty Victoria, Gillian Garner, Michael Stannon, Jane Dixon, George, everyone, and the Young Liberty for Law Reform, the pods as you call them. I don't know where that comes from. I'm sure I've forgotten some of the people, but the Wheeler Centre are planning to extend this discussion on their website, so do have a look at the website, wheelercentre.com, hoping for some prisoner responses and also responses from victims of crime too. So do have a look over the next week or so. I'm sure I've forgotten some names, but thank you so much for coming.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.